I'm doing a session just about my experiences in my 16 months in South Africa. I certainly don't pretend to know everything about South Africa or what's happening there or all of the politics and all the intricacies. In fact, usually when I talk to people, I tell them that the longer I was there, the more confused I got. Not about the general fact that apartheid is an abhorrence to human people, of what it does to families, to individuals, to the country, but how to go about dismantling apartheid and how to go about the reforms and how to go about change and what it's going to do to the people, which now aren't just people, they're my friends, is really hard for me to figure out. I don't have any answers, and like I say, the longer I was there, the fewer answers I felt I had. I thought I had more answers when I was here and when I went over there. I want to show you some pictures and slides. The slideshow is probably not very political, and I didn't mean it to be. It shows a little bit about where I was, what I did, why I got there, and a few of my friends that you will meet. I'm ending with the African National Anthem, which is Nkosi Sikelele Afrika. The words in Zulu, I can sing some of the words. I found another translation or a few more verses, and I'm not very good at Zulu. I only learned how to say Sanibona, Yebo, Njane, Siapila, which just means hello, how are you, yes, I see you, I am fine. You know, that's about all I learned to use because the seminary was in English, so I didn't have to learn to speak Zulu, although I would like to very much. So for those of you who may know a little Zulu, or if this tape stays around and people come later who know Zulu, I apologize for it. But at least it gives a little idea of what the language sounds like and the translation. When I read it, there'll be a translation read in English, so you'll know what the translation is. Then at the end of the slide, I'm sure there'll be time left because it's not very long. Then hopefully you will have questions. You probably know some about South Africa, have ideas about South Africa. As I say, I don't know some answers, but I have a lot of feelings about the place. People had told me before you go to Africa, and when you've been there, it's inside of you, and I've realized that that's true. It's somewhat very hard for me to be here, to be back, especially because my friends are in the middle of all of that right now, and I have no idea how they are, because it takes mail a long time, and sometimes there's just no energy for them to write. So it's not so easy being here. But I'm glad to share a little bit of my life that I had in Umfumulo, South Africa. Somebody get the lights, please.
Can you show on the map where they are?
Sure. These people aren't going to be able to see. This is a map of South Africa. Maybe I'm going to take it down, although it's very small. Stand up. Oops. This is South Africa. You see it enough. It's not a very good map, and it's my one I use for traveling, so it's a little ragged in the edges. South Africa. Namibia, it's shown on here, but it's very large. It goes up quite a ways. Cape Town, which you might all know about or heard about. Johannesburg and Pretoria are up here in the Transvaal. They're the different provinces, the Cape Province, the Transvaal, the Orange Free State, and Natal. And I was in Natal, which is the Zulu province. Mostly Zulu people live there. And Natal, there's a city called Durban, which is on the coast of the Indian Ocean. It's a beautiful city, it's a resort city. Most people from the Transvaal, from Johannesburg and Pretoria, every holiday, you know, you don't want to be on the highways because everybody's coming down to Durban, to the beach. It's usually warm there, even if it's in the wintertime, it's a little colder. And I was about an hour and a half north of that in the country,
positive.
How far between Cape Town and Johannesburg?
I don't know what it is in kilometers. It probably says on here. Say Johannesburg and Cape Town, 1,439 kilometers. So that's much more. It's about 3,000 miles.
I don't know, about 850 miles.
We never had snow, so more like Florida or something. South Africa is a beautiful land, whether you're looking at Cape Town's Table Mountain, surrounded by the dry, open areas of the Lebowa homeland in the Transvaal, enjoying the grandeur of Natal's Drakensberg Mountains, swimming in the Indian Ocean, or hiking above the Atlantic Ocean, or spending some time within the green rolling hills of KwaZulu. To use the title of a book by Alan Payton to describe this place, "Ah, but your land is beautiful," and it is. But it is also a country filled with pain. The political system of apartheid, established in 1948 when the nationalist government came to power, legally separates all races. You have separate places to live and separate places to work. Apartheid affects everyone in South Africa in some way, whether you are white, so-called colored, Indian, or African. My journey to South Africa began on the 12th of August, 1984, when I was commissioned by Fullness of God Lutheran Church and the Holden Village community through the auspices of the American Lutheran Church. I was sent out with love and joy to learn as much as I could and to serve in the library at the Lutheran Theological Seminary Umphumulo, located among sugarcane fields and rolling hills and valleys of KwaZulu. The seminary serves the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Southern Africa, or ELCSA, as one of two seminaries. In 1985, there were 39 students. English, one of the two official languages of the country, along with Afrikaans, was the medium of instruction since the students' first languages were many. Students represented the Northern Sotho people, Tswana, Zulu, Xhosa, Venda, and Swazi. The so-called colored students spoke Afrikaans. The term colored is the legal classification of a mixed race person. Even though ELCSA includes a few Indian congregations in the Durban, Natal area, there were no Indian students studying to be pastors at this time. ELCSA is a predominantly black church, black meaning African, so-called colored, and Indian. Though in 1985, a small white congregation joined this church. My work in the library at the Lutheran Theological Seminary, LTS, involved reclassifying the entire library collection. It had been in one German individual system, and we changed the books to the Dewey Decimal System. I assisted Bai Ossing, an ALC missionary from Minneapolis, in this task. We were not able to completely finish the task during my 16 months there, but got very close. The work was a joy, something I loved to do, but the most positive aspect of the job was its location. The job allowed me to be in South Africa, to learn more about the people, the country, and myself. While there, I was able to visit some schools. It is common for elementary classes to have over 60, even 80, or even 100 students in them, being taught by one teacher who has no more than a high school diploma, if they have that. Prior to 1953, most Africans and so-called coloreds attended missionary schools and were quite well educated. But when the nationalist government implemented Bantu education in 1953 and took over all of the schools, the quality of education fell. In fact, Bantu education was established to keep the non-white as second-class people. They were educated to be miners, domestic servants, gardeners, street workers, etc. They were discouraged from dreaming of being equal, of being business people, or doctors, or theologians. One small primary school near Umphumulo is one begun by Mrs. Ntuli. With support from the local community, who helped build the school, she provides an education for the little children, who would be unable to walk the long distances to the other elementary school. Mrs. Ntuli is a strong, educated, and hopeful woman. When her first building's mud walls collapsed, she taught under a tree until a sturdy classroom could be constructed. She is trying to provide a quality education. There are fewer students in her classes than most KwaZulu schools, and the Red Cross Assistance Program provides soup for the mid-morning break. Many children come to school having eaten only a small amount of mealy meal or cornmeal porridge and are hungry, so the soup is a real gift. There is some hope for change in the educational system, but at the moment, at least three times the amount of money is spent on education per white student than an African student. Education is important at all levels, whether it be elementary, high school, seminary, or university. When there is a new South Africa, there needs to be an equal educational system for all races. The church is an integral part of the lives of most black people in South Africa. As well as being part of their lives for religious reasons, the church also serves a social function. The church buildings may be different, like this chapel at KwaZamagugle, this mosque in Lanesia, this church center at Lobital, or this Evangelical Lutheran Ovambo Kobango Church in Onipa, Namibia. But in them all, people gather together for worship and celebrate their togetherness at weekly services, as well as events such as funerals, weddings, ordinations, and women's league meetings. For Christians, the celebration of the Eucharist helps us all to remember that we are one in Christ, no matter what our color of skin, or religion, or nationality, or language. The head groundskeeper at LTS, Mr. Mafongo, is an evangelist for Elks' Notweni Church in the valley below Umphumulo. The building serves as a primary school during the week until Sunday when it gathers a small group of Christians together to worship. There are very few Christians in the valley, so the church is struggling to survive and still evangelize the area. Several people from the LTS community joined Mr. Mafongo and some children from that area to help in repairing the rundown building. Broken window panes were repaired. Walls were painted. A little flower garden was constructed. And a toilet pit was dug. It was a long, tiring day of hard work, but we were all glad that we had shared in the improvements. Another enjoyable time for me was observing the Abasi-Zagazi meeting at LTS during our winter holiday in late June of 1985. Abasi-Zagazi is a Zulu word for the Women's League, or like any of the LCW. It was amazing to see Umphumulo's population grow from 25 to over 1,000. The women arrived by bus or kombi, slept on every available floor space, met in a huge tent, and all assisted in the cooking, and the serving of the meals. The close of their gathering was a Eucharist service presided over by Bishop Blamini of the Southeastern Diocese. The church-related highlights of my time in South Africa were being able to attend and celebrate the ordinations of two of my closest friends, Joseph Standar and Newton Brandt. They were truly celebratory occasions as they entered the ministry, committed to serving the people in the difficult unrest situations in South Africa. As Newton, the person on the right, once wrote to me after violence had broken out in Cape Town townships, "Marianne, I want to pick up a stone and throw it at the police, but I know I simply can't because of my commitment to ministry." He's a believer in nonviolence as a way to effect change, but it's not easy to be nonviolent in that country. There's so many things to tell you about, so many feelings to share, so many thoughts and things to show you that all reflect South Africa as I've experienced. The young and the old, the educated and the gifted who neither read nor write, the wildlife and the abundant variety of flowers, the homes of the wealthy, the homes of the poor, the homes of Gandhi in Phoenix and Lanesha, and then Robben Island, the former home of imprisoned ANC leader Nelson Mandela. Those who work as weavers and spinners, cooks and teachers, old friends like these who came to visit, and new friends like Satati and Abram, Styx and Magoma, Ula and Torsten, Vi and Rolf and Ostri, Matsumai and Zoba, Maho and Sammy. I share with you the reality of the whites-only sign at the Durban Beach, which says, under Section 37 of the Durban Beach bylaws, this bathing beach is reserved for the sole use of members of the white race group. And the reality of the Ecumenical Center Trust, a building which houses many organizations, secular and religious, who are committed to the struggle to end apartheid. These people and organizations, though often persecuted, are a glimmer of hope in the polarized country of South Africa. I'm closing with the words of Nkosi Sikelel' Afrika, both in Zulu and English. A great sadness for me is not to have gotten recording of the LTS students singing it, which they did with a lot of feeling and which always brought me to tears. Nkosi Sikelel' Afrika.
God bless Africa.
Malukapum umpando luayo.
Raise up her spirit.
Yiva imitandazo yetu.
Hear our prayers.
Usi Sikelel'.
And bless us.
Sikele amazo asizwe.
Bless the leaders.
Sikelel'. Kwa nomlisela.
Bless also the young.
Ulitwal ilizwe ngumonde.
That they may carry the land with patience.
Uisikelele.
And that you may bless them.
Sikele amalinga etu.
Bless our efforts.
Awonanyana nokuzaka.
To unite and lift ourselves up.
Awemfundo nemviziswano.
Through learning and understanding.
Uasikelele.
And bless them.
Yisla Moya, Yisla Moya.
Descend, Spirit,
Yisla Moya Oyin Muele.
Descend, Holy Spirit.
O Sisikeleli Afrika, Malupata Nisu Tumalayo, Iswaini Tanda Soyetu, Gosi Sikelela Tinda Busapulwayo. O Sisikeleli Afrika, Malupaka Nyesu Tumulwayo, Iswa Imitanda Soyetu, O Sisikelela Tina Lusapulwayo, O Samoya. Shavasayesu, O peri sweatin kwalema swenyeho. Morena baloka set Shavasayesu, O peri sweatin kwalema swenyeho. O sebuloke, O sebuloke, set Shavasayesu. Shows the relocations of the peoples of South Africa. When the whites decided that they would create the homeland system and put people where they believed they grew up and where they should belong, someone sat down to figure out where everybody should go. When it comes out with a map, you have the idea that the person who did it was a little bit confused, because they just move everybody. And they move some people from, be like moving someone from Chelan to Wenatchee, and then you move people from Wenatchee to Chelan. And then you move people from Wenatchee to Leavenworth, and then you move them from Leavenworth to Kashmir, and you just keep going like that completely. There are two missionaries in a place called Tabanchu in the Orange Free State. They're missionaries from the United States with the ALC. And the people that are living in their area, in their township there, a relocation area, have been moved 5 times in their life. And many of them aren't very old. They say, how do we start the people or get them involved in trying to have a garden or keep your home nice? Why should they bother when they're going to be moved again maybe next month? The government has come out and said, we don't move people anymore. But it is still happening. They just call it by another name. If the people get wise to what name's being used, they can create a new name. I'm not sure what it's called right now. There's some people that just at the first of the month, first of the year, that had fought for 2 years from being moved. They had established their home, they had hospitals, they had all sorts of little government systems, and the white Pretoria government just said, sorry, we've given your land to these people, so you have to move. You have no choice. They fought it for a long time, but eventually they get tired of fighting or it doesn't work anymore, the fight. I can read you, there's a newspaper that comes out and is published in Johannesburg, which is the largest city in South Africa. There was a newspaper there called the Ram Daily Mail, which was a daily paper, and it was quite an honest paper, and therefore it died. It was forced to die because it was too honest and told the truth about too many things. And I don't know all the business manipulations, but they came in and pushed it down. Well, the people that worked for the Ram Daily Mail decided there has to be a voice for the people other than the state-supported newspapers. So they started their own paper, and it's a weekly paper called the Weekly Mail. They took their own money and their own savings and began this paper. Each week, they come out with what they call the apartheid barometer, telling what's been happening in the week. This is the last one I picked up in the country before I left, so they have it for the year. For example, 1985 detentions from January 1st to December 12th, there were 10,836 people detained. Most of those were let out, but there were 1,336 still in jail. To be detained means you haven't been charged with anything, you're just being held. You haven't gone up to trial, you haven't gone up for a judge, you have no rights, nobody comes to see you. In many cases, parents don't even know their children are in jail. They think they just disappeared. There's another death in police custody. Number of people to have died in detention or in police custody for an alleged political offense or during a period of political imprisonment for last year were 85 people died, and they have no idea why. Deaths in the township conflicts from January to December of 85, 818. These were all verified facts, and in fact, they're probably small compared to what the reality is. I don't really know what else to say. There's a poem I want to end with at the end, but if there are questions that you want to ask, I'd be glad to try.
When did this paper go out, when it was finished? I mean, was it still being printed in
the paper? Oh, this is the new one that's just started, the Weekly Mail. The people from the Rand Daily Mail took their own money and savings and started this one. So it's still going, we hope, for a long while.
That surprises me that they are committed to.
In the last couple of years, they've allowed a few more things to happen. For example, some of you might have seen the Nightline programs that ABC did. We were allowed to see a few of those on the South African television, which is all under the government, which people who had been there for 30 years were really amazed, the missionaries that had been there. That wouldn't have happened about 5 or 10 years ago, because they're loosening up some. There are a few things on the radio news that you wouldn't have heard a few years ago about what's happening. But you still get a very slanted idea of what's happening there. I used to listen to the English language news. I didn't speak Afrikaans or Zulu or anything. And it's under the state, under the Pretoria's government. It's watched very carefully. So I listened to it to hear what the white people were being fed. And anything about Tutu or Bosak or anything was very slanted against them. So the whites heard that they were doing everything wrong. There are, Venda, Botswana, Transkei, Ciskei, and they were talking about Kwakwa becoming independent soon. And one other one up in the north. But there are four right now that are officially independent, only recognized by South Africa. Otherwise, you have the areas where people live, Kwakwa, Laboa, Gazungulu, Gwazulu. Generally speaking, the land is arid and not fertile. But the main reason for that is the overpopulation, because some of the land is quite good. Some of the land in Natal is beautiful. The greenery that I lived in grows beautiful sugar cane and a lot of greenery. But what has happened is when you drive from the seminary at Umpumulo to the coast, where there's a town called Stanger, you cover about 25 miles or 40 kilometers, and you drive in and out of Natal, which is the white province, and KwaZulu, which is for the Zulu people, and you can tell immediately when you're crossing the line. There's no line on the road or no sign that says, but you can tell, because when you're in KwaZulu, you have lots of huts, rondavels, lots of people, and usually it's very mountainous land or the hilly land that they're allowed to live on. And then you'll drive in the next spot and there'll be beautiful, gently rolling hills with just acres and acres of sugarcane. And that's where the white people live. You'll have one house here and one a few miles away. So they've grouped all the people together on that land, which probably could support a few people, but they put so many people there that it's not even possible. There's a place not too far from Umpumulo called Untanjambili, and there are many American missionaries throughout the past 100 years. I was there with someone who had just come back after several years, and he couldn't believe the number of people that they settled in one area, in a very hilly area. There were maybe four families there before, four little rondavel huts. And all of a sudden, there were hundreds. And those four families could probably be okay, but not hundreds. The other whole thing that I haven't talked at all about, which many of you might have heard about, but might have more questions, is the whole system of pass laws and influx control. Those are the two main bodies of apartheid, the main crux laws. The influx control, or the Group Areas Act, says that you can only live in certain areas. As a white person, I can only live in certain areas. As my friend Satati is an African, he can only live in certain areas that have been decided by the government. But you're assigned to an area, or in your passbook you have it stamped that you can work in a certain area. And if you do not have a stamp that says Johannesburg, you cannot live there. You cannot work there. That's the influx control. Therefore, many people can't get a job in the city, and there are no jobs out in the homelands, out in the area. You see, it's overcrowded. There's very little food. There's very little water, and there's no jobs. If a man can get a job in the city, for example, if there was someone from here who got permission to work in Seattle, you could go and work in Seattle, but your family has to stay here. You might get home once every year, maybe twice a year if you're lucky, and some people only get home once every 2 years. They jokingly call it conception leave. You go home and you have 2 weeks with your wife, and then you go back. The next time you come home, there's another child, and it goes on. That's the only time you see your family. Your children are raised without knowing who you are. And then if your family has the right to live with you in the city, they have put the township so far out and the transportation so difficult that it takes you a long time to get into work. So you'll get on the bus or the train at 4 in the morning, or start walking for 2 miles to get on the bus or the train. Start at 4 in the morning and maybe get home at 7 o'clock at night. And what do your children do? They don't see parents. They don't see family. So the whole system of apartheid ruins people, because you have no, as individuals, you have no self-respect. You can't live where you want, work where you want. You've been told all your life you're nothing. You're just educated as a minor, as a domestic worker. You can't be anything else because you're African. And it also splits the family completely.
Do the students, like at the seminary, do they get special permission to be there, or is that a different situation?
Well, the seminary is built on what's called glebe land, and that is technically white land and not, I don't know exactly, it's a special category, which means that all races can live there. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I would have had to have a permit to live there, because it's in the middle of KwaZulu. Mm-hmm. But it's a special little blotch of land. That was 10 years ago.
That was my question. How did the apartheid affect your living? At the seminary, you were very free to...
The seminary was very free. When I first got there, I liked to run or get out and walk, and women in South Africa, at least African women, do not wear pants or shorts at all. And so at first I didn't, for the first few weeks, and I would just walk around in a skirt so people got used to seeing me. And then I started running, and people got very used to me. You know, here's this white person again, you know, running by in the sugarcane fields. What was affected was, for me, I didn't have a car, and the only way I could have gotten into town was get a lift with one of the missionaries, one of the lecturers, because the bus transportation is only for African people out there. And I had one student that was very politically inclined, and he kept challenging me on that, saying, well, why don't you get on the bus, you know, and go, even so. But the problem was, that's okay for me, but you also get the bus driver in trouble. And I wasn't willing to do that, because they need their jobs. They're in real, you know, in rough shape, and if they got a job, you'd hate to put them at risk. I was never scared for my life at all, living where I was. Many people heard about the violence, what was going on, but I was out in the country, so I was, you know, it was never a problem.
Are there black lecturers?
Mm-hmm. We had half and half. We had four missionaries and four Africans. So there, we had a white community of no more than 10 people. And the students were only 39 and maybe about 10 more African lecturer families. And then, but we lived around, surrounded by the Zulu people, who are very wonderful, wonderful people.
If you wanted to go to neighboring villages and visit, what would you do?
You could. I didn't very much because of not speaking the language. People who were educated before the Bantu educational system came into being in 1953, people my parents' age or my grandparents' age in the 50s, 60s, 70s speak perfect English because of their education. People my age and younger and in their 40s, their English was very ragged. And the students who came to the seminary's English was very ragged. So going down into the valley, many of those people hadn't been educated at all.
Even in Zulu, they weren't even literate.
They would be able to speak, but not read and write. Most down in the valley.
English or English?
No, they would speak Zulu, but not read or write Zulu, and not English. They might know hello, but that would be about it. The students, I was always really amazed. You know, the unifying language, as I said, was English. It could have been Afrikaans, but they don't refuse to speak Afrikaans because of it's the language of the oppressor. But I have enough problems reading theology, and English is my language. And here they are studying seminary, 4 years of seminary in a foreign language. I don't know how they could survive.
Where did they get English then?
In the schools.
It is taught as a
Well, it's, a, it's an official language, English and Afrikaans. So they start... When they start in school, they start in their own language, whatever it is, Zulu, Sotho, Xhosa, whatever. And then the first language they add, maybe age second grade, is English. And then the next year they add Afrikaans. And they study them all the way through. But you know, if you've ever studied a foreign language, you know, it's different when you don't practice it or use it, and they go home and use their own language.
I believe your pictures showed only male students at the seminary. Did you have any?
There were four women students last year. And there, I've just heard that there are five this year, so there's one more. The year I took a lot of pictures, there weren't any women students. There are two ordained pastors in ELSA there, women. One now has gotten married to another pastor, and they haven't figured out what to do with her yet, if they allow her to be continue being a pastor. Because the pastor's wife in South Africa is the head of the Women's League, the Amasisigazi, with the black and white uniforms on. So if she's a pastor too, I don't know who's going to lead the Amasisigazi. You know? And it's very, very rare that you have a student who's a single person. Extremely rare. It's a very difficult situation. First of all, it's rather chauvinistic. Still in its tradition and culture, but also because of the Abbasisigazi. And the other thing a friend of mine, Satati, told me is that most people in your churches are women, because the men are in the cities working if they have a job, and you do a lot of counseling, and you run into lots of problems because there are lots of lonely women, and if you're single and on your own, it's really rough.
Was that true when you showed that little church where you went out and helped your parents and so on? And then you had one picture that was all women. I didn't know if that was a women's group or that was...
No, that's the congregation. I think there was one young high school boy there the day I was there, and then he left early. Other than Mr. McClongo, you know, that's the only man that's there.
You talked about evangelizing in that valley. What are the people if they're not Christian?
Probably traditional religion. Yeah. You will hear on, when is it usually? Saturday afternoon, the Saturday evenings, you'll hear the noise up from the valley once in a while, the drums, calling them to worship, or during their worship. Worshipping of ancestors, I don't know all the things. But there aren't that many Christians down there in that valley. The other movement that's growing in South Africa, a Christian movement, but not established, is the African Independent Churches, which Tim probably knows about. And they're growing by leaps and bounds. And the students talk about that quite a bit, about why the established churches are losing so many people and why the independent churches are growing. There are about 3,000 now independent churches. I could set myself up as my own, as a prophetess, if I had a vision, whatever, to start my own little church. And generally speaking, this is very generally, they're apolitical and rather charismatic. And the people will often come to just escape from the realities of their life. And many people say that's one theory anyway, why the established churches are losing people in the African independent churches. They have to face all that stuff every single day of facing the apartheid. They don't want to face it in the church and get a sermon that's trying to raise their consciousness on Sunday. That's one theory.
Maybe they're the one here days enjoying mass discovery.
Yeah, maybe. That's true. I don't know if you've heard this, but maybe they don't want to hear me as a joy of man's desire. That's another theory.
What do you think about the possibilities of that peaceful solution versus a violent change? And what do you think about people who argue that a change of the system will mean that bloodshed and white.
Again, you remember that I'm only talking from me, but I would like to have a lot of hope in it, though, that it's going to be peaceful change. I think the people are tired, they're angry,
and I think they've had it. And there's an element of white South Africans that seem to realize that. There's a strong, not large, but a strong element that wants apartheid to end, that hate it, you know, that want all people to share in South Africa. There's also a very strong conservative element on the other side that say, never, this is our land. You get out, or you just serve us, you just wait on us. And those people, I'm afraid, are not going to give in very easily. Personally, what I kind of sensed is that there's, at this point, in the Africans that are very strong for apartheid to end and very, not necessarily violent, but very strongly committed, they realize that South Africa is for all people there, for whites as well as Africans and the so-called coloreds and the Indians that are there. What I feel, what I sense, is that the longer the time goes with the whites digging in their heels and saying no, no, and giving little platitudes and ending the petty apartheid stuff, just makes the Africans say, when this all ends, goodbye. I hope that doesn't happen. You know, I have hope, but not much optimism. It's civil war in the townships, in most of them right now. A friend of mine from Cape Town, she's a white person, Janelle DeGrucci, and what she commented to me once was, living in white Cape Town, you forget that what's going on out there, because you're so separated in your areas. It's not like a suburb in Minneapolis where you drive in and out of Bloomington and Richfield and all these, and you have no idea that you've changed. It's there and there and there. The white people are here. The so-called coloreds are there. The Africans are there. And you can get along very well just in your white area without ever knowing on what's going on out there. It's hard to believe, but it's possible. And she said, she wrote to me once and she said, it's civil war out there, but you have no idea when you're driving around the middle of Cape Town that people are burning out there, that people are dying, that people are being shot. I'd like to have more optimism. I have hope only because of my faith that God is a God of justice. And it's a beautiful country, and the people are beautiful. And it's a shame to think.
Did you have a chance to get to know some of the whites outside the missionaries that work at the seminary?
No, that's one thing I missed. A few whites. There was a student union Christian Action meeting, an interracial group of Christian students that met at the seminary, and I talked with some of them. It's not easy to be a white person there either and take a stand, because you end up in a lot of trouble and end up detained as much as the African.
How has your library project been getting completed?
I was working with someone. And she's still there. I went to help her, mm-hmm. and then she's still there to carry on. And she's hopefully training an African person to take over. But that's really difficult because library skills, some of them are very specific and very detailed. But a librarian, an African librarian, coming out of the University of Zululand can get over 900 rands a month, and the church can only pay 200 rands. The pastors in Elks only get 225 rands a month to live on, and that, in dollars, when I left, was about $100 a month, no matter how big your family is or what. So the church is not...
And how does that compare to other employment, like a public school teacher or...
Well, like I was saying, a librarian can go out and get 900 rands a month, and a pastor gets 225. I think they're trying to raise it now, but they just don't have a lot of money.
And the church is self-supporting me?
No, not necessarily. The church gets a lot of money from its partners overseas. It's partners with the American Lutheran Church, Church of Sweden, Church of Norway.
But I thought there was a policy of not subsidizing national salaries for the ALC.
I don't know.
It could be that one of the other partners does, though.
Could be. I know Germany pours a lot of money.
Are you completed with your work here now, or are you going back
something else? It was a contract situation, so I finished.
What will you be doing then?
I don't know. Hopefully finding a library somewhere. Why don't I end with the poem that I'd like to read? It's called To Lesizwe. It's written by a white South African student. And then we'll close, and if anybody wants to stay and ask more questions, I'll be glad to stay around. Or I'll be here till Monday if you want to talk to me. To Lesizwe. God, you've heard all this before, but I have to ask again, why? Why do you permit so much suffering, so much misery and human anguish? Why do you allow rich and poor, some to be happy, and others, damned, it seems, forever to lives of despair? Jesus, you were born in a stable, and I'm sure it wasn't as romantic as those Christmas cards would have us believe. But have you seen those migrant hostels where 24 men live in one room? 16-year-olds and 60-year-olds herded together, knowing the only privacy provided by towels draped around their one beneath the other bunks. Perpetual dingy darkness to accompany their washing, cooking, eating, sleeping, playing, talking, having sex. Overfull barrels, too few to serve the natural digestive needs of people holed up in those barracks surrounding a courtyard of muck. They expect us to live in this pigsty, confides a fellow human being to me. God, I know students who own their own two-bedroom flats. Why? Do you wish to have it so? Are you some autocratic despot decrying misery for masses and favor for few? I see multi-storied mansions, and I see corrugated iron shacks. I see gardens that go on forever, and I see patches of desolate sand. I see swimming pools and tennis courts, and I see dirty puddles in which little children play. Why? Why, God, do you love so discriminately? Families living in tents, not big enough for even a double bed. Rows and rows of these canvas bags. The nearby bush, both playground and lavatory, breeding disease. God, those plastic shelters! Even your stable has nothing on those. Hole-ridden plastic shelters from torrential rain and dusty wind. Flimsy, foundationless shelters from police harassment, bulldozers, and guns. Oh, God! Oh, God! Oh, God! I've downed my hot chocolate. I'm ready for bed. The rain's pouring outside, snuggled up under my three blankets, shielded by walls and windows and roofs. I've said my prayers. God bless my family. God bless the government. God bless me. God bless all poor and hungry people. God bless. Just 15 minutes drive away, babies, women, children, men, people, human beings huddled together in drenching rain. Police spotlights glaring at their misery. Policemen drinking coffee, clutching tear gas canisters, wielding batons, watching, laughing, joking, not feeling. And in a torrent of anger and guilty frustration, complicity, hatred, and bitterness, God, are you real? Are you and do you really love?
Are you just and holy? Then why? Why? Yet deep down I know. Yes, I know the answer. I know that you are just, that you are love, that you are holy, merciful, gracious, forgiving. And though I cannot see, I know, for you tell me so through your word. I know too that though you create and sustain and provide, you do not apportion unjustly, but it is us. We, sinful humankind, who take but do not give, who steal and never return, who clutch, accumulate, exploit, indulge, mindless of the suffering, pain, and anguish we cause. And because I know you, I have hope. For where there is sin, there is suffering. And where there is suffering, there awaits judgment. And after judgment, restoration, peace, justice. God, judge me. Judge us. Let it be hard, but let it be soon. For the present suffering is too much to bear. Tula Sizwe, be quiet, nation. Ngabokala, do not weep. Ujehova Wako, Uzongobela, God is going to conquer for you. Nkululego, freedom, freedom. Ujehova Wako, Uzongobela, God is going to conquer for you. God, I believe in you. Let not my faith be opium faith. Let not my song be opium song. Let not my hope be opium hope. But see the suffering, judge, and restore.